count to 13.
1001, 1002, 1003, 1004, 1005, 1006, 1007, 1008, 1009, 1010. 1, 2, 3.
This is Bob Brown. I'm interviewing Joe Mazurek at his office in Helena on September 25th, 2008. Joe served in the state senate from the election of 1980 to the election of 1992, I believe. Is that right, Joe? Mm-hmm. And then was Attorney General of Montana from 1992 to the year 2000. And so we'll begin our interview by asking you, Joe, where were you born and when?
I was born on July 27th, 1948, in San Diego, California. My father went through the wars at Guadalcanal, and also the landing forces in Nagasaki, and so anyway, that.
So he was stationed in San Diego in the Navy.
Yes. Yeah. He had those. So,
what created your interest in politics and public service?
In school, I always wanted to be the president of the class. I was the. I enjoyed government already, but that was in junior high and high school.
Do you suppose there was a person or an experience or something that triggered that interest?
Well, I attribute that to my father. You know, go and do what you want to do and do it right. And so that was. My dad was somewhat involved in politics, but not much.
And so you discussed political issues a little bit around the family that you
we did.
And that sort of
thing? Yeah. Yeah, and my mom, who died young, was she was also, pushing me to do that sort of stuff as well. Yeah, she was from Williston, North Dakota, and my grandmother had I think here's 8 children, and she raised them as a librarian, and every one of her children got a college degree.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, one of my uncles was Bill Kenning, who I'm going to the Chicago 7, and I'm trying to remember which one of the ministers that in that organization they were he became a Quaker, and he was in prison during the because he wouldn't
he was a conscientious objector and
yes
because he
but he yeah exactly
wow
yeah yeah so.
That was during World War II.
After World War II.
After World War II. Yeah, so you became influenced, or you became interested in politics at an early age, and you were influenced by both your mom and dad, ran for class offices, that type of thing, both in junior high and high school, and also in college, if I remember.
Yeah.
Because you and I had that experience together.
Yeah, we did, we did, yeah.
You were student body president at the University of Montana in Missoula.
Yeah, and that was an unusual occurrence because I was a student representative representing the senior class at the university, and in the beginning of our year that year, Ben Briscoe and Bruce Gray were the two young men who were the president and vice president of the ASUM student government, and they got a motor pool car and drove to the Democratic convention in Butte, and they were arguing for raising the
lowering the drinking age
is what it was. Yeah, so Anyway.
They were killed in a car wreck, was that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. They were going back to the university that Saturday afternoon. And anyway, it was a tough deal.
Terrible tragedy. Yeah. And you were, as the senior class president or the senior class representative on the student government,
yeah.
The student government got together the other student senators and elected you student body president because both the president and vice president were killed in the car accident.
Well, and there was one other catch there, and that was there's a kid from, what was his name? The treasurer of the ASUM was Mark somebody from Three Forks. And anyway, and he just declined. He was a numbers guy.
I see. And he was kind of technically next in line.
Yeah, he was. That's exactly right. Yeah. So.
But he declined it, and so the student government then elected you.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a big burden fell on you then because I remember having a telephone conversation with you shortly after that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I know it was a real shock for all of us, and it was one of the saddest funerals I've ever attended.
Yeah, me too.
So then I think I kind of know, because you said you were interested in politics, you have been since you were a young person, but what motivated you to run for the state senate here in Lewis and Clark County?
Well, I had a number of people, I had come back to Helen now, I was practicing law with Goff Shanahan and Johnson and Waterman. Anyway, I think there were three people came around and talked to me. Mike McGrath was one of them. He was
active in Democratic
Party. He was getting there. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, and so I got some. Somebody told me Tom Rasmussen. I sort of heard that he was sort of wasn't really sure he wanted to run not or not.
He was the incumbent senator.
He was the incumbent senator in this district, and so I actually went down and made an appointment and visited with him, and I just said, you know, that I really want to do this. I understand you may not be you're not sure you want to run or not, so. But I told him, and he thanked me for visiting with me and giving him a heads up. So
did he end up running then?
That's the next story. on the Friday before the Monday of the deadline for filing. Two new Republicans popped in.
Really?
Riley Johnson.
Yeah.
And Riley Johnson and Doug Kelly.
Okay.
There's a guy who was.
And Doug Kelly was very pro-life on the abortion issue, Rasmussen. Mm-hmm. So that might have been there might have been a connection there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But
So then
Rasmussen didn't file.
He didn't file, and Doug Kelly, about 3 weeks out, said he just wasn't going to do it, and so they tried to get Riley to do it, and he wouldn't do it either. So I got a pass.
Even though these guys both filed?
Yes.
But neither one of them decided to run?
They decided not to run. And that was...
Well, how did you engineer that?
I don't know.
Well, that's great.
Some lively leprechaun on my shoulder.
Boy, that must have been. Well, that doesn't happen very often,
no.
That's for sure. So you didn't really have a very competitive race or a competitive race at all.
No. Well, I did, as it turned out. John May, I missed this.
Oh.
Jack Mahan,
the doctor, medical doctor.
He was in D.C.
the veterans attorney who was the national president of the DFW or something.
That's right.
Like that?
Yeah, he was.
He got into the race.
He got into the race on my side.
So, in the primary.
Yeah, in the primary.
I see.
Yeah, and so He got in. We ran our race, and at the end of the day, I won. In fact, I did not lose a machine in the county.
You annihilated me. But you'd grown up here.
Yeah,
course,
yeah. He was a neighbor.
Oh, really? Well, of course, he filed after you did, though, so he challenged you.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Were there any issues or anything involved in the campaign, or?
You know, not really. I just wanted to get there, and I just, you know, I didn't have a, you know,
How would you describe Lewis and Clark County politics at that time? That was the election of 1980, right? Who were the key leaders? Kind of, if you could just kind of summarize the political scene here in Lewis and Clark County in 1980, how would you?
The county attorney was Tom Dowling, I think. Him or Charles Gravely, but I wasn't tuned into county politics at all. I
politics, but just were there two or three prominent political leaders here in Helena or in Lewis and Clark County at that time?
Tom Judge, yeah.
Who was the outgoing governor?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So.
Any important legislators or?
You know, I don't know. I don't think that.
Tom Harrison still.
Tom Harrison. I'm not sure he would have been one if I think that's right. Tom was very active.
Glenn Drake.
Yeah, he was a land use guy. He did a lot of real estate work. And,
if you look at Lewis and Clark County when you started out in politics, I'm sure that public employees were an important consideration to anybody running for public office.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'm sure that's still the case now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just kind of curious to know, as you reflect back, whether the politics of Lewis and Clark County has changed particularly from 1980 to the current time. It seems as though perhaps there were a few more Republicans elected 25 years ago than would be the case now. Not sure about that completely, but how would you describe the change that's taken place? How is it different now than it was when you started out?
Well, you know, I'm trying to remember who the Republicans would have been. Well, Glenn Drake, obviously.
Tom Harrison.
Tom Harrison.
Mike McGrath,
he was the Speaker of the House then, I think, and so.
And would you describe the political environment in Lewis and Clark County today about like you would then?
Yeah, probably a shift from Republican to Democrat.
What accounts for that?
I'm not so sure. They knew we'd do a good job.
Well, I thought you were going to say, well, the people have wised up.
That's exactly right.
Okay, all right. Okay. You got to the state senate. You'd lived here in Helena, so you were familiar with the legislature.
Oh, yeah.
Many people who run for the legislature, literally, at least in our era, had never been in the Capitol building before the first day they were sworn into the state legislature. I know that's happened many times, but in your case, you were familiar with the building. You were probably familiar with the legislature. Mm-hmm. What were your first impressions when you got into the states and began your service there as a freshman member?
Well, I remember was it was really exciting. It was just, we could get there. struck up a friendship with Gene Turnage. He was sat across the aisle from me, and he was very good to me.
Was he president your first session?
Yeah, he was, because Stan came up next.
Yeah, okay.
So.
Did you consider Turnage a mentor figure?
Absolutely. He was very good about that. So.
But you were excited and enthused about being a member of the state senate.
Yep.
And any other first impressions of any kind?
Well, I tried to. I was really excited because I was a lawyer coming into the Senate, and I wanted desperately to get on the Judiciary Committee. So we did, didn't we?
you and I both were on the Judiciary Committee that session.
That's what I've always said, Bob. The one thing I can say, you and I sat together every day, and I think where there were three quick committees, Education, Judiciary, and
Taxation. We had the same three committees for 12 years, I think. Well, 10 years, because you were president the last position. Yeah. But that is literally true. And I think we did, because we developed a good relationship, we were able to accomplish some things. Sometimes when the conversation began between you and I, we could have pretty significant influence when the two of us got together on all three of those committees.
Yeah, that was good.
Are there any other senators in addition to Turnage that you remember that kind of stand out in your memory and that you were there?
Yeah, I mean, Matt Hinsel always stands out. There stands up.
Pat Regan?
Pat Regan and...
Pat Regan was a woman senator from Billings.
Yep.
Matt Hinsel, a Republican from the Flathead, and Pat,
what was the other?
Billings.
Chet Blaylock. Yeah, the chicken eater.
Now, what's that story?
No, he didn't you accompany him down to the Suds Hut to have chicken occasionally?
No, I think that story was about Van Valkenburg.
Oh, okay.
I think Bruce Crippen tells that story about Fred Van Valkenburg, and we're not sure that's true, and I'm not sure we ought to repeat it on the tape, but it was that when we were having a... I guess I could probably say it. We were eating chicken at the Suds Hut. Bruce remembers this, and I don't. But anyway, Fred was eating chicken, and he was getting kind of animated as he can get, and kind of intense in the conversation and that sort of thing. And Bruce remembers that he ground up some chicken bones in his teeth and just swallowed the chicken bones and all. And he said it had quite an impression on both he and I. And I tried to remember that, and I can't. I'm not sure it didn't happen, but anyway. But Blaylock was someone, of course, that we served with. You and I both served with on the Education Committee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we got to know him well there. How would you describe the influence of the Anaconda Company and the Montana Power Company in the state when you were in the state senate?
You know, I've... I've looked back and thought about that. I don't remember what was going on at that point with the Anaconda Company. And I'm not sure...
It lapsed out of the picture.
Yeah, it did in the 80s.
Shortly after you got there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's when...
But you know that there's a... I got my mouth full of cinnamon roll here, but you know there's a belief based on a lot of pretty solid fact, in fact, that the Anaconda Company had an enormous influence over our state and its politics for several decades.
Oh, yeah.
And it was in the decline when you and I got there. I was there a little bit before you, so I probably remember Anaconda Company lobbyists and their involvement some more than you do, because I think by about the 83 session they were pretty much gone. But I guess the purpose of that question is just this theme in the history of Montana about corporate dominance. And sometimes people associate the Anaconda Company with the Montana Power Company, again, because they were pretty closely associated in a business context earlier in their history. And so some people think that the corporate dominance of Montana politics was exaggerated, and some people think, no, it was pretty real. And I'm just curious of your impression, whether we're talking about the Anaconda Company or the Montana Power Company. The Montana Power Company, of course, was around for a long time, all the time we were in the state senate. What are your impressions about this, the theory of the corporate extremely important corporate influence, particularly as you relate that to the Anaconda Company in Montana.
Well, it was interesting to me. One of the law firm I was working with is one of our clients was the Montana Power Company, and I actually even did a little lobbying for them later on. But
after you left the Senate,
after I left the Senate,
Do you was your impression that the Anaconda or that the Montana Power Company was a how would you compare it, say, to the AFL-CIO in terms of its influence in the legislature?
Yeah, that would be a stand-up battle between two giants.
Well, they typically, I don't think, squared off very much, but they both had influence. How would you compare them?
I'm trying to recollect.
The lobbyists for Montana Power, John Lahr?
Yeah, John Lahr, and well, he was the principal lobbyist.
Mike Bichette?
Was he doing it then?
Maybe he wasn't doing it.
Yeah, I think he was doing it. He wasn't doing it then. Yeah.
Later, but well, how would you how would you describe Lahr?
He was the consummate lobbyist. I mean, he just he was a stand up guy, and he was I mean, he was good to work with and
effective.
Very effective.
Why? How? What was his what distinguished him from other lobbyists?
He did his homework. I mean, he really did. And that's well informed. He did a good job for his company.
And he was able to wasn't he the lobbyist that the Montana Power Company had assigned to the Democrats? Mm-hmm. He had a Republican lobbyist and a Democrat lobbyist, and he was the Democrat lobbyist. So, given that Democrats are somewhat suspicious of business interests, how did Lahr get beyond that? How was he able to be effective with Democratic legislators?
You know, I think that he just outworked them. So yeah, and he was also a fun guy.
What do you remember about him? Is there a story or something that you can remember about a dinner with John Lahr or experience with John?
I never got into the gin deal they had. You know that
Beefeater's gin.
Beefeater's. Yeah. Well, yeah, that
some kind of gin. I think it was Sapphire Bombay gin.
Yeah, Bombay gin.
Sapphire Bombay gin, and John Lahr had a group of guys that had hit
George Oshinsky and some others. Yeah,
George Oshinsky was a lobbyist for the environmental organizations.
Yeah.
Probably not typically on the same wavelength with John Lahr, but John apparently had a wide circle of friends.
Oh yeah,
and that were all over the political spectrum, and he managed to have credibility with all of them. And in some cases it was the gin, in other cases it was his logic. I guess.
Who knows? Okay.
But you had a good working relationship with him.
With John? Oh yeah, yeah. Very, very much so.
Let's see here. Just a few more names, Joe, that I want to bounce off of you and get your impressions of. Did you ever know Jim Murray, the great leader of the AFL-CIO?
Oh, yeah.
What do you remember about him? Story or anything about him?
Yeah, well, I have a story a story that's between him and I that we laugh every time we talk, and we still do it. I went to it was Christmas time, and his wife, I think it's Earlene.
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, and anyway, I was shopping for a Cuisinart for Patty, and so I went up there and got my Cuisinart from Earlene, and I how'd she say this? I bought Patty a Cuisinart, and somehow he got bamboozled into to the highest level of Cuisinart, the best one in the shop. And he didn't. I was being a cheapskate because I was a young lawyer and with not much money.
Yeah.
So every time I see him, we talk about this.
So she sold this to you, and she sold you a more expensive
thing? No. She sold, I bought from her, and then I don't know how, somewhere in all of this, somebody called, slow down. I guess it's just an inside joke, but we just laugh about it because anyway.
What is a Cuisinart?
Cuisinart is a, I'll bet you, ask your wife.
Okay.
It's a machine makes dough and that sort of stuff. Those sorts of things. So that's what it is. And they're expensive.
And Erlene was selling these?
Yeah, she worked at the store.
Okay.
So apparently one of the Murray boys called and said, "Get that Cuisinart for him."
Well, great. How about Don Judge?
Yeah, Don actually was someone who kind of helped me get into the Senate at the time. Yeah,
he did. McGrath came by and visited with you about the possibility.
Yeah, Tony Jewett was part of it.
Who was an environmentalist at the time and later became an official in the Democratic Party, I think.
Wasn't
Tony Jewett the executive secretary of the Democratic
Could
Party?
Could have been. I don't know. Because he's got a big deal. He does. All of the, I don't know whether it's the Yellowstone Coalition or something like that. I don't know what it is, but yeah.
Don Judge, of course. Jim Murray was the leader of the FFL-CIO.
Yep.
Then he left the state to take another position with the FFL-CIO and another part of the country, and Don Judge then became his successor.
Yeah.
And Don Judge was one of the fellows that recruited you to run for the state senate to begin with.
Yeah.
And then Tom Schneider, who was the leader of the Montana Public Employees Association when you were a state senator, and of course many public employees.
Oh yeah, I was always with him. I wasn't going to miss him.
What was he, an effective lobbyist?
Very much so.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, he probably, because you had so many his members as your constituents, you probably were naturally an ally of his.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was easy to work with, though.
Oh yeah, very similar.
We both served on the education committee, and so we had a fair amount of contact with the Montana Education Association. Mm-hmm. What are your recollections of Eric Fieber, the leader of that organization?
I think Eric is, and still is. I mean, I think he's doing a very good job at MEA, and I think he's still got the fire. We're all about the same age, but he's.
Was he an effective lobbyist? How would you describe his approach to lobbying?
He could be fiery and not afraid to express a position that he'll defend a position.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So
how would you compare him, say, to John Lahr as a lobbyist?
I want to be careful here, because I think Eric does a good job, but he sometimes, gets a little too fiery, but he does a good job for his organization. So
Laura would never be fiery.
No. No. Uh-uh. Yeah.
And my recollection is that Fieber was more inclined to present testimony before committees.
Yes.
And he could be articulate, he could be pointed, he could be funny, he could be
sarcastic,
all of that.
Exactly, all of that.
And whereas Lahr was someone whose approach to lobbying was more a lobbying of individual people having a conversation.
As opposed to just committees,
And he may have presented some testimony before committees, but his forte was more the individual approach, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are there two or three pieces of legislation that stand out in your memory in the years that you served in the state senate?
Mm-hmm. Yes. First one, and I'm not sure when the date was, but it was Veterans Preference.
Oh, I remember that too, Joe.
God damn. Dennis Taylor, I tried to figure out how to get around that. Jesus. God, it was just horrible.
Well, it was. I think you and I had the same problem on the same bill, but describe how you remember it. Veterans Preference.
Well, yes. Now, there was, I'm trying to remember the name of the lady who, there's a woman, God, what was her name? Anyway.
Was she for a women's organization?
I don't know. She might have been. Uh-huh. I don't know that. But it got real big. It wasn't just this one person. The problem, we had a horrible problem in front of us because the Supreme Court had just approved that she could get all the benefits she in otherwise. Anyway, uh-huh. What they were trying to do was saying the veteran's preference that was approved by the court included every time you go to a different position or because it would follow you for your whole career.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was what the problem was.
That was the problem, yes. Because I remember it after World War II was over,
mm-hmm.
there was an effort to try to get the veterans integrated mm-hmm. back into the job force. And so if you were a veteran, you got some preference in getting a public job, like working for state government.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow or other, that got interpreted apparently by the courts to mean that preference was ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you got a state job and you wanted a promotion, you got an advantage in the promotion. If you wanted another state job, even maybe 10 years after you'd gotten back into the job force again, you continued to have this preference.
It was just, that
and
was
people,
a,
some of us, like you and I, thought, hey,
that's nuts.
We're both veterans too, but that's nuts.
I mean,
you ought to be able to make it on your own after you've got the advantage in getting the job. So mm-hmm. anyway, there was legislation in the early 80s, mm-hmm. I think, on that.
There was. We somehow, I don't remember exactly what we did, but we fixed it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And I remember Stan Stevens, Joe, was a combat veteran
mm-hmm.
of the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw it the same way we did.
Yeah.
And you and I were both veterans, and so the veterans organizations were just hammering.
Oh, yeah.
Unrelenting. And
Bob Durkee.
Yeah.
He was the lobbyist for
American Legion.
American Legion, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a good man.
But he had blinders on when it came to that particular
legislation. Yeah, he did. He and Dennis Taylor taught a lot. Dennis was a wounded Vietnam vet, and he was in charge of the personnel in the Department of Administration. So he was getting hit by everybody. So,
what side of it was he on? I didn't remember.
He was on our side.
Yeah.
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 But he was doing it as his position was.
And I know the women's.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. The women's groups, or at least some of them, felt that, since most of them weren't veterans
mm-hmm.
at that time, that this gave an inherent advantage to generally to mm-hmm. men
yeah.
over other men, but almost all women.
Mm-hmm.
So they felt it was unfair too.
And yeah.
So, but anyway, so that was a hot issue when we were first
yeah.
in the Senate.
And the other one I remember, and it almost it was stream access.
Oh boy. Yeah.
That the first time we did that, I put Yellowtail on the. That would be 4 years later, wouldn't it? Because
probably,
yeah,
I can't remember exactly when it occurred, but Yellowtail, Senator Bill Yellowtail from down in the Hardin country,
yeah, yeah,
was carrying this bill that would allow the general public access to navigable streams in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And the ranchers,
were nuts.
Large private property owners, didn't like this because many of them had streams that were at least technically navigable through their ranches, and they didn't want the general public parading through there with fishing poles and hunting rifles and that sort of thing, possibly causing fires and leaving litter and that sort of thing. So they considered it a trespass, and Bill Yellowtail and his backers considered that the general public had the owned the water, basically.
Well, up to the high water mark.
The right to have access to any of this public property up to the mean annual high water mark, as I remember it. So the problem we had was that Jack Galt, who was a prominent senator and a big rancher with a lot of land, hated that bill because
they
it created enormous problems for him. And Bill Yellowtail, who we were also friendly with, mm-hmm. was an intelligent guy and also had a defensible point of view, was carrying the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what happened? How did you end up voting?
For Yellowtail.
Yeah.
But we put him in a bad spot, really. I mean, because he was... rookie, and but
he was a brand new member and had to carry that huge bill that was intensely controversial.
Yeah.
And when you say we put him in the spot,
I'm a
you were chairman of the Judiciary Committee then?
Yeah, so that would have been the second
that would have been an 83 or 85, probably 85, because the Democratic majority
yeah,
85.
85, yeah, yeah, okay, yeah. And I was chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and I gave that responsibility to carrying that bill to him.
Was it a Senate bill or a House bill to come over from the House? I think it was a Senate bill.
It was a Senate bill. And
so what was it? Was it that we knew this had to be worked out because of some kind of a legal problem? And so
I don't think there, but I
how did you end up having the responsibility of assigning that legislation to him?
I was the chair
of the committee. Yeah,
that's right. And so he, but yeah.
Had you requested the bill to begin with?
No, I hadn't done it at all.
Yeah.
But it was coming, and So.
Anything else?
Not really. I was trying to think of one other one, but I was looking at public school funding and what we were doing on that.
Yeah. We had a special session once on that, I remember.
Yeah.
And that got
was
so
that,
complicated.
Was that the Stevens regime? Or
that's
was
what I remember. I remember
that's what
you
I do
and I
too.
On a hot summer day when Sweet Hammond was chairman of the Education Committee, and you and I were both still members of it, and Sweet was so perplexed. I mean, it was technical and difficult, and we were having such a difficult time with it. And that was the beginning era, remember, of the spreadsheets? Remember that? And so everybody was an expert, and we're just driving the poor guys to distraction who could run the set of the numbers, and every tweaking of any bill would change to some extent its impact on the different school districts around the state, which would trigger another avalanche of these damn spreadsheets. And we were up to our beezer in spreadsheets, I remember, in that committee, all of us trying to figure out what it did for the whole state, what it did for our own districts, what it did for our own counties. All of it, of course, had huge property tax implications.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, too, Joe, that you and I agreed one day that we were so overwhelmed by this and so tired of it. I mean, it was an issue that had ceased to be interesting, and it was just an unsolvable, perplexing puzzle. And the one
to this day,
and the one person that could kind of help you and I, both of us agreed on this to kind of figure out what the heck we thought on it, was Madeline Quinlan. Do you remember?
Oh
that?
Yeah, she's still there.
She still
does all that.
Office of Public Instruction, but she was sometimes the people who are experts can explain something to you in great detail so that when they're finished with their explanation, you feel as though you know even less than you did at the beginning. And Madeline was one of those kinds of people that could make you feel like you knew a little more at the end of the conversation than to begin with, and seemed to be able to be helpful in clarifying things. So anyway, I
you want to take a break and get a cup of coffee more or not? Are you all right?
No, if you're okay, let's just go.
Well, okay, that's fine. That's fine.
Yeah, if you're okay, let's
go. We're now looking to Schwinden.
Yeah. Just your recollections on Governor Schwinden.
I thought Ted Schwinden was a great governor. He the only quarrel I would had with him is he's a farmer and he doesn't like to spend money. As a Democrat,
but you were fairly conservative, as I remember, in terms of spending money.
Yeah, that's right.
And, and some other things. And but we used to think of we Republicans at least used to think of Ted Schwinden as really quite partisan. He was a solid, loyal Democrat.
Oh, yeah.
But he wasn't a particularly liberal Democrat.
No, that's right. That's right. Yeah, he was he's a PhD
close
historian.
To it. I think he was all but dissertation in his PhD. How would you describe him? Was he a smart guy?
I think he was brilliant. I mean, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I owe a couple things that I worked with him. And when he left the governor's office, he was the Stillwater Mining Company's brought him in to
as a member of the board of directors.
And then when he, gosh, when was this? This was just in the last, in 1999, he was getting older and his wife was having health problems, and so he called me down to Phoenix, where the Stillwater Mining Company was having a board meeting, and he was going to be resign on that one, and they were offering me up, and so they he was very helpful to me. I mean,
so then you replaced him on the board?
Yes.
And I'll bet that was an interesting new insight.
Yeah, it's amazing, yeah.
How would you describe Ted Swindon, Joe, if you could describe him in a couple of sentences?
He's smart. And he gets along with people very easily. He's a great public person. So,
did you ever have an experience with him that's kind of memorable, that kind of typifies who he is?
I was trying to think.
You met with him, I'm sure, numerous times.
Oh yeah, lots. And you know, I went on a trip.
Did you go to Japan with him?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we went there. Yeah, that was good. We had a good good time there. You know, that was fun. Not as much fun as you guys had the first time.
Yeah. How about Stan Stevens, Governor Stan Stevens?
High blood pressure. I mean, really. I mean, right.
Well, he was frequently red in the face.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know we've wondered what the cause of that was, and certainly could have been high blood pressure.
Yeah.
So, but when you said high blood pressure, did you mean that in a descriptive way?
Yeah, just sort of, he sometimes could get hot. But I thought he was a good legislator. He, in fact, I consider him a friend. Even though we spat over the public school stuff, because we put a bill out there that was pretty pricey.
Yeah.
And he just said no.
Yeah, it was more expensive than he wanted to sign.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. But I'm curious, because I don't remember him as volatile at all, but I do remember him as serious, and we all respond to stress in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember sometimes Stan seemed to be red in the face beyond any normal
mm-hmm.
redness in the face, and there were sometimes we thought, gosh, is he about to have some kind of a stroke or something? But that was 20 years ago, and he's still with us, and he doesn't seem to have that red in the face condition.
No,
as much as
I think he's
maybe it was stress related in some way.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah.
What kind of a public speaker was he?
I think he was a very good public speaker because he was a radio guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
he was effective in floor debate?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, he was real good. Yeah.
How about, and then when he was governor, did you ever have any business with him when he was governor? You were president of the Senate, weren't you, when he was governor?
Yeah, I was. And that was when Ted Shy was trying to sell a plane. And
the governor's airplane.
Yeah, and that got him off on a bad...
Because the... he and his wife both felt the existing governor's airplane was unsafe. There was some reason they had to believe that, so they wanted a new airplane, and then the legislature got into a big rack of frats over what new plane there should be and how expensive it should be and when the old one could be fixed up and all that sort of thing. Yeah. You got in the middle of that?
Well, just trying to bring him down, because, I mean, ultimately it worked out. But, yeah, he was, you know, he just, well, it was a Van Valkenburg deal, you know.
I mean, I think now, Fred Van Valkenburg was the majority leader at the time?
Yeah.
And how was he involved?
He grabbed a hold of that bill, and, you know, his bill, and he was kind of watching it pretty closely now. And anyway, he you may remember, because I remember that's one thing. Well, in fact, Fred has actually talked about this in our little meetings when we come back together.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we
in an impish kind of way about how he really got Stevens going on the thing. I never really understood in detail the inside the story on that. I'm going to interview Fred too, though, Joe, so I have not interviewed him yet, but I will. And but anyway, what your recollection of that is that it kind of, it was maybe made you somewhat uncomfortable trying to figure out how to find a solution to it?
Yeah, it was difficult, and I'd be curious to see what Fred's recollection was.
Fred's recollection. I interviewed Governor Stevens, too, and I don't recall that he mentioned it. But, you know, Stevens, I always found to be a very circumspect, somewhat proper gentleman.
Yeah, he is.
Very careful and inclined to kind of let bygones be bygones and that sort of thing. And so when I interviewed him, I don't remember that it came up, but it might have.
Yeah.
How about Governor Roscoe?
I think Mark Roscoe is the consummate public servant. When he left the governorship, he had $10,000 in the bank. He was in a rented condo, a rented vehicle, and he took all his retirement money and paid off his kids' college loan. Now that's a guy that...
So he basically was starting all over
again
in life at the end of his terms in office as governor.
Yeah. But he fell into it.
Yeah, he fell into it. Got into a good job back in life.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Well, first of all, he got George Bush.
Yeah.
You know, he was in Florida.
Yeah. He was in the post-presidential election of 2000. He, as Bush's fellow governor, was down in Florida advocating for Bush, and we saw him on television.
All the time,
And then after the...
But, you know, we were really good friends. I mean...
You and Mark were good friends.
Yeah, we were. Yeah. Just not... He was good.
And you followed him as Attorney General.
Yeah. And he was helpful there.
Yeah. So. You were able to keep some of his staff people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very much so.
Do you see him?
You know... No, I don't. I mean, he's got this big, huge house up there.
Up on Swan Lake, I think.
Yeah, by the terrace there.
By the terrace up in the Flathead Valley on Swan Lake. Uh-huh. So we think he comes home in the summer sometimes, but I haven't seen much of him either. So.
Yeah. Yep. Well, Teresa's got her name in the phone book, so you can call her.
I could. I maybe should. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe should. How would you describe, if you were comparing the leadership styles of Schwinden, and Stevens and Roscoe? How would you do it? How was Roscoe's, because you defined both Stevens, or rather both Schwinden and Roscoe as consummate public servants, and yet I think they were different individuals with a somewhat different approach to the office.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
How would you compare them?
You know, I think Mark quickly makes decisions, and I've felt that, and what as the AG with. Talking to him as the governor, he can make it. He doesn't labor over issues. Uh-huh. He's going to read it, look at it, and that's it. And he won't change his mind.
So when you were Attorney General, if you had a conversation using the telephone over some kind of a issue or something or other, Mark was usually pretty. He was able to make a decision and stick with it probably in fairly short notice.
Yeah.
And that would have something to do with the fact that he had been Attorney General at one time, mm-hmm. too, before he was governor. And then, so that's part of Roscoe's leadership style. He could make a decision, do it himself, probably not in collaboration with other people.
Yep, no, he's his own guy.
Now, how would you describe Stevens, or Schwinden, rather, in that way? You were a senator when he was governor,
yeah,
so you had a little different relationship with him. But
I can't remember any specific. Anyway, but he like Roscoe. He'd made decisions. I think good decisions as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then, how would you describe Stevens's leadership style? Because we both served in the Senate with him.
Yeah,
as governor.
We went, and I think we went in to a meeting in his office or in the conference room one day. Wasn't there where we were talking about school funding?
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was in his office or
in the governor's conference room.
Yeah. That.
What do you remember about?
Well, I think it was the same thing with me, where he didn't want to pay the piper.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about that, I think. And he didn't like it, and that was fine. And it was, you know, probably a good thing. It was a good thing that he did.
What motivated you to run for Attorney General?
Well, who wouldn't? What lawyer wouldn't want to be the state's lawyer?
Well, but Joe, I think it requires a degree of confidence that you, uh-huh. you know, that you obviously felt you were equal to the job and that you could do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Were the people encouraging you to do it?
Yes, very much so. And yeah, it was. That was good. Anybody who's ever been an attorney general will tell you it's the best job they've ever had. Really.
Why is that?
Because you have you have to know what you're doing. And you know what we're really trying to.
What was enjoyable about it? I mean, it's a good job.
It's a great job because I was gonna, because I wrote some stuff. I've got some stuff.
Yeah, just go ahead and find it.
I've got it. Yeah, okay. You know, it's essentially the Department of Justice is the domain of the AG. And so we started some initiatives when I was elected, and we had some interesting times.
Yeah.
In the
AG can make decisions about whether to pursue litigation with things,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, you might decide that it's worth pursuing or that it's not worth pursuing,
mm-hmm.
and that's a big public responsibility,
mm-hmm.
of course.
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Yeah. Go, okay. It was a very interesting time for me to be there, and this is the time from 1993 to 1997, things that were going on then, the anti-government activity in the Freeman.
Oh yeah.
Remember all that stuff
absolutely.
That was going on?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and then in 96, the Unabomber, we worked on that one.
Did you meet him?
What's that?
Did you meet the Unabomber after he
no.
was? You didn't ever interview him.
The feds were.
It was strictly
the
federal.
Yeah. So, but then we had the uh, um, youth violence meetings in 94 and 96, Nancy Keenan and I got together and we had held a series of town hall
Nancy
meetings.
Nancy Keenan was the superintendent of public instruction.
And so we went all over the state.
Because of concern about gun violence in schools?
Yes, and as a result of the Jeremy Bullock was killed in Butte on this playground.
By another student?
Yes.
With a gun?
With a gun, yeah. So,
and so that
anyway.
Triggered a lot of public interest in Montana.
Oh, yeah, it did. We went down and walked, we had these...
Yeah. Now, Jeremy Bullock would be the younger brother of the fellow who's now running for Attorney General?
No, it's
Steve Bullock?
Steve, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, he...
They're related anyway.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. Steve is his uncle.
I see.
Yeah, so... Okay, so we marched through Butte every year. then came the speed limit. Okay.
Oh, the speed limit was also an issue you had to deal with?
That's in, May 1999. Successfully proposed the legislature authorized a numerical speed limit, which took effect May 28th. The limit on the interstate was 75 miles per hour, 70 miles during the day, 65 at night. Okay.
Yeah, and that was when you were Attorney General.
Yeah. And I actually tried to defend the reasonable and prudent law, and
tough to defend.
Yeah. It just wasn't. Yeah,
wasn't defensible. So
no.
So that's why.
Well, it's not that it wasn't.
Why did you feel the numerical speed limit was a good idea?
Because it gave you certainty.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so we created a child protection unit. At the legislature's request to assist county attorneys in child protective cases. That is something that we did. One of the best things we ever did was we created a new crime lab in Missoula in February of 2000, and we were able to then, we've really ramped up in terms of all of the equipment you need and everything like that. That was opened and it's been very successful. Here's another stream access coming up. Access to streams from bridges, county bridges.
Oh yeah.
I can't get away from that stuff.
Yeah, I know. So. And there was other legislation. I was out of the picture at that time, but you were Attorney General.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And I don't remember, but new legislation did pass pertaining to when a...
There was an AG's opinion is what it was.
Okay.
Yeah.
The public had access to a stream from any bridge.
A county bridge, yeah, on a right-of-way.
Any public bridge.
Yeah. So, yeah. In 2000, we took on with almost every state with the tobacco settlement.
Oh, yeah.
In 2000. And we created a permanent trust fund for at least 50% of the tobacco settlement funds Montana was to receive.
And that was a big class action lawsuit against the tobacco companies?
Yes.
And Montana got a share of that.
Yes.
And at your request, the legislature passed a bill to create a trust fund for that money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The other ones were just, these are beyond 2000, but legal highlights, argued the Egelhoff case and the coal tax case before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Wow, you argued both those before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, no, I did one part of it, and Clay Smith did the other on the coal tax case. The Egelhoff case was it's a Egelhoff was a guy who actually started out here in East Helena and went up to Libby, and it was the morel seasons. Season. And yeah. Anyway, he was a guy who...
Morel mushrooms.
Yeah, yeah. And that's... Yeah. So, anyway, Egelhoff, he was just a drifter, and he got hooked up with some people up in is it Rexford? Yeah, I think that's probably where it is. But anyway,
up in Lincoln County.
Yeah, Lincoln County. Anyway, he had driven, the deal was that he actually was in the back seat of a car where these two people were in, and anyway
he shot them both.
He shot them both at different times and out of the same car. Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
And they were all three kind of itinerant mushroom pickers. Or?
Yeah. Uh-huh. The deal was, it was a due process case. In other words, the Supreme Court denied Egelhoff's case.
He got capital punishment?
No, he didn't. He didn't. He's still in prison.
I see.
Whether
he got due process in his trial?
The due process part is that
wrongfully arrested or something?
You get due process, but they. Yeah, so we argued that case, which was a good thing, and the coal tax case was with the Crow tribe. We did two of those then, and then next the interesting or the one of the things that the next thing that came was I had two executions to take care of, so.
Is the Attorney General responsible for executions?
Because we have to there has to be a warrant, and there's a process you have to go through to make the execution. And
so you basically supervise two executions?
Yeah. Well, we because when these people are on death row. The U.S. Supreme Court once they've made their decision, we can go forward, and so that's what we did. Duncan McKenzie.
Yeah.
Lana Harding.
Yeah, Lana Harding, who was the daughter of State yep. Senator Ethel Harding, mm-hmm. with whom
yep.
we both served.
You bet.
And McKenzie was convicted of her murder, of Lana's murder.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so that execution was carried out in the penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
But because you were the head of the Department of Justice, as the mm-hmm. Attorney General, mm-hmm. you had general responsibility for carrying it out. Is that right?
Yeah. And McKenzie, he sought. And my good friends Ron Waterman and Ward Shanahan took me over on Saturday morning.
And what?
And we had a hearing about whether Duncan McKenzie should be
executed.
Executed, yeah.
And Waterman and
my two Shannon, former partners, yeah,
your former law partners, and they were opposite you on that.
Yes,
on that case.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And Waterman is currently running for Chief Justice.
Yes. Yeah. Against, well, he's just running.
Against McGrath.
Yeah, okay.
Did you have anything to do with gambling as attorney?
Oh, yeah. Yes. You and I know a lot about that, Bob. Okay.
Because the Attorney General's got some important regulatory responsibilities in
regard to
gambling.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Monitoring the machines and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we do all that. Let's see. Well, I don't have a whole lot of stuff about that, but I'm lucky to have one of my former public information officers, she dug up a bunch of stuff for me.
That's great.
Yeah, so at least I've got something to say help you there.
Anything else that you remember from Attorney General you want to talk about?
Oh, let me think here.
You went to national meetings.
Oh, yeah,
other
we
attorneys
did.
General
yep,
around the
yep,
country.
Yep, yep.
You met Elliot Spitzer, I imagine, or
yeah.
Did you?
He came in late, but
I see.
Yeah.
Later became kind of the controversial governor of New York. Dan Lundgren from California, pretty prominent attorney general.
Who's that?
Dan Lundgren.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
He's. I got along with him. Didn't like him at first, but
Was there an attorney general from anywhere in the country that you particularly admired or particularly stands out in your memory?
The guy that helped me most was a guy named Robert Del Tufo, who was the New Jersey
attorney general.
Yeah, and he was. He gave me some help on how to do some things in the office, and that was good.
Really? As you were breaking in?
Yeah.
As you were coming into it as Attorney General?
Yeah. So.
What motivated you to run for governor in 2000?
I just had to be the governor.
I remember talking to you about that.
Yeah.
And I told you, I said, you know, you'd get a lot of Republican support if you ran for Chief Justice. And most of us like you, but it's difficult for us to stick our neck out for you when you run for a partisan office like governor.
Yeah.
But we could do a lot of stuff for you. And you said, no, you said, I'm more interested in policy than I am interested in deciding court cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just much rather be governor. And I think you mentioned, too, that the guy that then was interested in running for Chief Justice that kind of concerned you was a fellow by the name of Treweiler, who you felt would have a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
And you felt that you much rather would wanted to be governor much more than Chief Justice, and might even have a better chance of winning.
Yeah.
So that's how I remember the conversation anyway. But what motivated you?
To be governor?
Yeah.
Because I wanted to be governor. I mean, I didn't go through this grade school, high school, college. I mean, I want to be there. I'm going for the brass ring.
Yeah, okay, all right.
It was that gosh damn Cooney. Really, I to my dying day, I will say, Mike Cooney kept me from being governor. He would not bend.
Now explain, because there were three of you running.
There were, yeah. And
Mike Cooney was the Secretary of State.
Uh-huh.
And Michael O'Keefe was the auditor.
Mm-hmm. And he had all
was
the big...
the Attorney General.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And... you were about to say that O'Keefe had what? He had all the big...
Well, he had all, you know, he had all the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
personally has a big fortune.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But why, what do you...
You
were talking about
actually,
Cooney.
Yeah, we're talking about Cooney.
Yeah.
Okay. It was at the Governor's Cup golf tournament up in Kalispell and Big Fork. We sat down at whatever that there was a restaurant across from the old what was the hotel that's now not such a great hotel as it was once was.
Yeah, the Outlaw Inn.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, we sat there and talked, and you know,
you and who? You and Cooney?
Cooney and I went. Yeah, we sat down together, and he's ready to go. Thinks he's going to win
for governor.
Yeah, and so he. he could have stepped back and he'd be the governor now.
Yeah.
So, well.
What you were proposing to him was that he run as your lieutenant governor?
Yeah, run with me.
Because the two of you would have been a formidable.
We would, yeah, absolutely.
Would have defeated O'Keefe.
We would have, and that's my point.
Yeah.
He. God.
Then you would have finished up as governor, and Mike could have replaced you. That was your thinking,
Huh? Or something like that.
Yeah, sure.
But it really.
But Mike was—he was certain he could prevail over you and O'Keefe.
No, he just wasn't. He didn't want to bend, is all.
Huh.
So anyway.
And who was his running mate? I'm trying to remember.
God, I don't know. Didn't he have a woman or something like that?
Possibly. Your running mate was?
Dorothy.
Dorothy Bradley?
Mm-hmm.
Why did you select her?
We're beyond the, we're out of the Roscoe years. So, anyway, she'd run
against Roscoe
for
governor in 1992 and lost in a close race.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a woman. She had important environmentalist credentials.
Mm-hmm.
So because there are a fair number of women and environmentalists mm-hmm. in the Democratic Party, you could see how that could help you. She's mm-hmm. very competent,
mm-hmm.
could have been governor.
Oh, yeah.
So those were all important considerations.
Mm-hmm.
And so you and she then both campaigned hard, worked hard, covered the state.
We did, yeah, we did. Yep.
Why did it turn out the way it did? What did O'Keefe going for him?
O'Keefe, I'm trying to remember, near the end down in Billings. O'Keefe. Trying to think about that. The one thing that I recall is there was a guy who was doing the polling for Judy Martz, and I'd worked with him on a something about breaked up the dams or something like that. Anyway, I wish I could remember the guy's name, but anyway, he polled for Judy, and there wasn't a single time in their polling that I was ahead of Martz.
Really? She was ahead of you all the time?
Wait a minute here. Just a minute. We got to figure this out.
Judy's pollster showed her consistently beating you in the polls?
No, just the opposite.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Did. Yeah.
And that's...
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a guy from Oregon.
Yeah. Bob something. I know.
I'll bet I can find it, too.
That's okay. Bob,
here, yeah.
I'm familiar with the guy, too. So anyway, so you felt you would be a stronger general election candidate
mm-hmm.
against Judy Martz.
Yeah.
And I believe that also.
Yeah.
So what did O'Keefe have going for him in the Democratic primary?
He had Carol Williams.
The wife of the former congressman mm-hmm. Pat Williams, mm-hmm. as his running mate,
mm-hmm.
and you felt she was helpful. Was she more helpful to him than Dorothy Bradley was to you?
Yeah, probably. I don't know. We'll see. I don't know.
Because better connected inside, what, to organized labor, perhaps, or
Yeah.
Do you think O'Keefe's money was important?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he just. Write a check.
But as you look into the future,
mm-hmm.
what do you see in Montana's future based on your 30 years of experience in state politics?
Mm-hmm. I I've lobbied since then, and a lot of it, and I'm not doing it anymore. I'm actually a retired lawyer. So, anyway, so. But having watched the way things go at the legislature now, it's just not the same as when we were all there.
Yeah.
I mean, so many of them are just coming from, they've not been on a school board, or they've not, it's just not as how can I say it,
together?
We just don't seem to do that anymore.
Yeah. Do you think it's term limitations?
That's part of it, probably.
It's more contentious now?
It is, yeah. It's always contentious. That's, we had our battles, but we came back together. So,
yeah.
So I hope that we can get back to the days where we all work together.
Work together more willingly, yeah. I think that's true, too. Anything else? Or we can
not really.
Well, sure appreciate your public service, Joe.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Bob.